I'm Tracy Brown, and I'm very happy to welcome you to the Sense About Science Lecture 2010. The lecture this year is in association with the kind support of the Royal Society of Medicine, in their beautiful building, the Institute of Physics and Engineering in Medicine, the Society for Applied Microbiology, and the John Innes Centre. The lecture's also being recorded for podcast by The Guardian. Before we get to the main business of the evening, I have a few announcements, housekeeping and so on. We've conducted a full risk assessment and concluded that in the event of a fire, your best bet is to leave by the doors marked exit. In the event of your mobile phone going off, your best bet is also to leave by the door marked exit. Some of you might want to keep phones on silent if you have a signal, and Twitter with hashtag SASLecture. I know some of that's already going on. And in the event of Spain v Honduras kicking off before we've finished, our Leonor Sierra has asked if someone can discreetly keep her informed of the score. You know, actually, I should pay tribute to Leonor at this point. Many of you work with her. And this year, so inspired by her work with David Spiegelhalter and Michael Blasland and Nigel Hawkes and many other leading statisticians on her production of Making Sense of Statistics, she designed the most statistically fair World Cup sweepstake for Sense About Science. She emailed us all to explain it, rearranged the existing groups to ensure that the combined odds were the same, and included one team from each tier, but a team that could never play another team in the same group, assigned teams who would not play each other, set out a score allocation with a different multiplier to reflect whether the teams are in tier 2, 3 or 4. I paid my fiver, and we're almost at the end of the group stage, but I still haven't finished reading her email. I'm joking. Actually, this is Prince of Wales' correspondence with government ministers in the last 2 weeks. Well, business over. We're delighted that tonight's lecture is being given by Fiona Godley on the theme, It's Time to Stand Up for Science Once More. And I look forward to introducing Fiona in a few moments. But first, I want to take the opportunity to share something with you about the year that we've just had and what lies before us. Because the aim of our lecture is not just a thought-provoking evening, and it's a good moment for us to all catch up and to see so many familiar and new faces, but it's a moment when we take stock and recognise the combined efforts to equip the public to make sense of science and evidence. And I think looking around the room tonight tells the story of the past year. I mean, many of you will have seen Voice of Young Science, early career researchers and junior medics who pressed the WHO into condemning the promotion of homeopathy for HIV, TB and infant diarrhoea. I see people here from the Royal Statistical Society and Straight Statistics who joined with us to produce Making Sense of Statistics and a public briefing on statistics in an election. Many of you here are people who have helped us to respond to the public's questions and to misinformation and pseudoscience on subjects including salinity in GM crops, the MMR vaccine, are home testing kits useful, is Wi-Fi safe for children, what's killing bees, confidence in seasonal weather predictions, peer review of climate data, safety of ultrasound scans, of mercury chelation, of toothpaste. Even on some more unusual subjects, such as the healing properties of organite, do anti-cellulite knickers work? Is there any truth to blood type diets? And the one that actually nearly brought us to our knees, is it hygienic to pee in the shower? And I'll leave you to find out who responded to that question for Sense About Science in the reception after the lecture. Seriously, I see Peter Wilmshurst, Simon Singh and others who have been affected by the threat and chill of our libel laws on discussions of science and evidence, something which has been very important to Sense About Science over this past year, and which has led to a campaign to reform the laws, something we joined together with English Pen an index on censorship human rights organisations to do, and that has gathered the support of over 50,000 people and many organisations who are represented here tonight, and has led to, before the election, manifesto commitments from all the major parties, and we've just had the coalition government reiterate a pledge to reform those laws. And Lord Leicester's private members' bill it will be before Parliament in 2 weeks' time. And this is a really important issue for us in the coming year too. And if I am more euphemistic this evening in my references, it's because I've also got three libel lawyers in my line of vision. And many people who have come and helped us to find our way through this very complicated area to look at how we can free up scientific debate from the threat of libel. I see representatives of medical colleges who have with us challenged proposals for professional registration of alternative therapists. There are people here who worked with us to draft the principles for the treatment of independent scientific advice, a hard-fought campaign that led to their adoption last month in the ministerial code. I also see people who have helped us by raising funds and providing resources, including Joe Beard, who cycled from Land's End, to John O'Groats to raise funds for Sense About Science. And I'm sorry that Aoife Hunt can't be here, but I do feel I have to mention her because she skydived to raise money for us this year. Successfully. That's not the reason she's she's not here. She's just got a cold or something. But I think all of that has shown that with small resources and dedicated staff and volunteers and a lot of goodwill, we can deliver a lot to public life in the broadest sense of that term. So it's been an amazing year. And previously, I've said all this to you about the stuff we've done together in order to talk to you about doing something of the same in the coming year. But this year's different. Because, quite frankly, I don't want us to have another year like this one. I don't want any more years to be like this one. I don't want hundreds of people, patients, journalists, concerned members of the public, contacting us to report another dubious therapy or medical claim that they've taken out a bank loan for or they have promoted to them. And another year of us only being able to respond to just a fraction of those. Another year of teachers telling us about the amount of pseudoscience that's going into the classroom, and another year of only being able to respond to a fraction of that. I don't want another year of writers, researchers, journals, bloggers, patient forums threatened with libel lawsuits and bankruptcy for speaking out on public interest issues. So I think really the time's kind of come for us to say not another year like the last one, but that we've had enough. And the reason why we've had enough is the work we've done this year has shown that we can change it, that we really can do something about misinformation, and we really can raise the standard of science in public life. And above all, what this last year has shown is what we can do when we work together and put our minds to something and question the status quo. In the year ahead then, and to some extent in the 5 years ahead, with a broader and more systematic approach, we can launch a campaign to raise public awareness of misleading scientific claims and pseudoscience on a scale that will reach everybody and make it very much a normal part of what everybody does when confronted with misleading scientific claims, medical claims. Our early career researchers, Voice of Young Science and other groups of early career researchers, through their myth-busting activities and their work on the WHO and homeopathy, have realised the value of the supportive network, not just here in the UK but internationally, to inspire and encourage others. So they are looking this coming year to do their first ever Congress internationally on standing up for science to inspire others to take that approach off worldwide so that they don't see another year like the one they've had, but one that really does encourage more people to take a part in public life. There are many organisations, and many of you work in those organisations and have been working with us, who are now willing to look again at what they can do to equip people to make sense of science for themselves. And what we're going to be doing is starting a more systematic approach to getting public commitments to stand up for science. And for example, with the Royal Medical Colleges, to set out a commitment to popularising standards of evidence. With increased support for libel reform, we can not just highlight in the coming year the widespread effects of the law and the damage to the public interest in open discussion about science and evidence, But we can change the law, including a much-needed public interest defence, to protect the rights of those who speak out to raise awkward facts and opinions. So we can actually change it so that we aren't facing, a year from now, at Sense About Science Lecture 2011, the same society and the same issues and problems, but we've actually gone some way to stopping them, to turn the tide rather than just to hold it back. We are setting up a development fund to help us achieve this boldly and irreversibly over the next 5 years, so that at the end of 5 years we can ask whether we even need Sense About Science at all. Well, that is why, I do hope you'll talk to us about this after the lecture and join us for a reception. But that is why, in the meantime, I'm pleased that Fiona Godley, Editor-in-Chief of the BMJ Publishing, is giving our lecture this year. An independent thinker, Fiona Godley shares the outlook that we can change things so that we aren't dealing with yesterday's problems tomorrow. She's championed the cause of evidence-based medicine and of openness in research. She's championed editors' responsibilities and led by example. In fact, she was one of the first editors to draw attention to the impact of the libel laws on scholarly publishing, and she came with us to Parliament to raise that publicly to MPs early in the libel reform campaign, something which then led to other people beginning to make clear that this was having an effect on their work too. It's a testament to Fiona's strong sense of social responsibility that when we discussed her giving the lecture on the theme of standing up for science, she didn't have to expand out from her medical background, but rather to narrow in from her wide range of social interests. And above all, we invited Fiona to give the lecture this evening because we know that she'll invite us to ask more questions and think new thoughts. Thank you. Fiona.
Thank you very much, Tracy, and thank you very much to all of you for coming. It's a real honour to have been invited to give this lecture, and if I hadn't been a fan of Sense About Science before, I certainly am now, having seen at close quarters their passion, dedication and expertise. I recognise this title suggests a sort of golden age of science when people stood up for science. I found when I was writing the lecture that actually it became a plea for greater independence in science and in medicine. And perhaps there was a golden age of independence born of the radicalism and rationalism of the 18th century, out of which this institution where we gather today grew, founded in 1805 as the Medical and Chirurgical Society. From the website for the Royal Society of Medicine, so some of you may know this, in 1786, Dr. James Sims was elected president of the Medical Society of London. He was a forceful and autocratic personality and held on to his presidential office for 22 years. Many members of the Medical Society were so offended by Sims's high-handed tactics that 26 of them met at the Freemasons Tavern, Great Queen Street, on 22nd of May, 1805, and resolved to form themselves into a new medical society, the Medical and Chirurgical Society of London, which became Royal Society of Medicine. These dissenters elected as their first president Sir William Saunders. The society was established for the purpose of conversation on professional subjects, for the reception of communications, and for the formation of a library. And it got me wondering about what would have been in that library in 1805 when the society was launched. And I spoke this morning to the archivist in the library who was kind enough to share with me the catalogue of 1816, which, as well as having all the classics one would expect, and of course Jenner's discoveries on smallpox vaccination, which must be arguably one of the most important printed works on medicine of all time. But it also had some other titles which I thought were intriguing. William Buchan's Observations Concerning the Prevention and Cure of the Venereal Disease. Astley Cooper, The Anatomy of Surgical Treatment of Inguinal and Congenital Hernia, 1804. William Lamb, A Medical and Experimental Inquiry into the Origin, Symptoms and Cure of Constitutional Diseases, particularly Scrofula, Consumption, Cancer and Gout, 1805. An Essay on Abstinence from Animal Food as a Moral Duty by Joseph Ritson, 1802. And then Richard Pearson's 1804 pamphlet, outlines of a plan calculated to put a stop to the malignant contagion raging on the shores of the Mediterranean, if notwithstanding every precaution to the contrary, it should unfortunately make its way into this country. The library would also soon hold vibrant new medical journals. The Lancet, founded in 1823, the BMJ, originally the Provincial Medical and Surgical Journal, founded in 1840. But medicine itself was in a feeble state, according to Peter Bartrip, the historian of the BMJ. It could offer the sick few comforts and even less hope. Despite the emergence of vaccination for smallpox in 1798, medicine, as it affected the vast majority of people, was little different from what it had been 100 years earlier, and it now faced the enormous challenges of huge population growth, urbanisation and industrialisation. Now, the BMJ's perhaps most famous editor, Ernest Hart, from 1867 to 1898, campaigned on many issues, and the Industrial Revolution gave him one of his major campaigns against baby farming. Children were given away, usually illegitimate children, to carers for money, knowing that the carers would neglect them and even murder them. This was perhaps one of the earliest examples of investigative journalism in medical matters. Ernest Hart advertised in a newspaper as a father-to-be, offering money for adoption, and received over 300 replies, through which he identified a woman and discovered that indeed she had been farming children and had registered the deaths of 7 infants in the previous 2 years. Ernest Hart's campaign led to the first legislation on protection of infant life, and although not immediately successful in curing the problem, was certainly influential in improving it. It was a time of cholera in Europe. In 1831, an epidemic in England killed more than 30,000 people. And although the stethoscope had been invented, there were none of the things we take for granted today: anaesthetics, asepsis, antibiotics. The mentally ill were confined and often treated like animals. Bloodletting was a standard response to almost any ailment. And the medical profession itself was starkly divided between hospital consultants, often powerful and wealthy, and general practitioners who had little status and were poorly paid. How things have changed. And into this environment, before the BMJ was launched, came Thomas Whately, a vibrant, charismatic man, determined to fight vested interest, nepotism, incompetence, and quackery in medicine. And he led a lively debate about the need for medical reform. Now, it seems to me that Sense About Science is tackling and fighting for similar things. Encouraging engagement of the public, helping people ask necessary questions. Why was this decision made? Was it based on evidence? How good is the evidence? Was it peer-reviewed? Now, these are all good and indeed essential questions, deserving a straightforward answer, and where necessary, a grown-up debate. But that's not always what people get, especially, it seems to me, in medicine. What they get instead is all too often obfuscation, self-interest, confusion, elitism, professional protectionism, and secrecy. It seems to me, the longer I stay in this business, that the evidence base for clinical medicine and health policy is in an enormous mess. So let's talk about the evidence base. Drummond Rennie, deputy editor of JAMA, is someone who has done as much as he can to evaluate the peer review process itself. And here is his comment on the state of the medical literature. There seems to be no study too fragmented, no hypothesis too trivial, no literature citation too biased or too egotistical, no design too warped, no methodology too bungled, no presentation of results too inaccurate, too obscure and too contradictory, no analysis too self-serving, no argument too circular, no conclusions too trifling or too unjustified, and no grammar and syntax too offensive for a paper to end up in print. Now, Drummond Rennie said that about 30 years ago, but I know, because I've asked him, that he would say the same today. And in case people think that this is a historical problem, published just in the last month or so, is this paper on reporting bias in medical research, a very thorough narrative review. And what these authors did was an overview of medical research from the German Institute of Quality and Efficacy in Healthcare. They looked at all the database of international trials that they could find. And they found that reporting bias represents a major problem in the assessment of healthcare interventions. They identified reporting bias in 40 indications comprising around 50 pharmacological, surgical, diagnostic and preventive interventions. And the list of treatment or conditions to which this applies is extensive, ranging from depression through cardiovascular disease, through urinary incontinence, dermatitis, diabetes, thyroid disorders. Really, the whole of medicine is affected by reporting bias. And what this means is that the effects of interventions, the benefits of interventions, are overstated, and the risks of interventions are understated. And this is a systematic issue across the whole of the medical literature. This report from McGarren et al. Really ties in with a large number of studies, and it's impossible in the time available to do those justice. But just to give you a sense of a few key studies that were published leading up to this very substantial report that's just appeared. In the study by Rochon et al. In 1994, she studied 56 industry-funded studies of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, and not one of them was unfavourable to the drug-funded intervention. So, I mean, statistically, that just is unlikely to be the case. Not one of them was unfavourable. Yank and Rennie and Barrow in 2007 looked at industry and non-industry funded meta-analyses of antihypertensive drugs. They compared the results and the conclusions, and they found that financial ties to a single drug company were, although not associated with favourable results, they were associated with favourable conclusions. And this is something that suggests the ability to spin the results in medical studies, and editors are conscious of this, but we all too often fail to pick it up. Lexchin, Barrow et al. In BMJ in 2003 found that studies funded by companies were four times more likely to have results favourable to the sponsor than studies funded by others. Again, statistically rather odd. And then Tramer et al. Did a marvellous piece of work, which is a classic example where they've identified successful manipulation of publication in journals by in favour of a drug. So what they did was they did a systematic review of the literature for this drug, and they found what they thought were 84 trials, including about 12,000 patients. But when they looked more closely, they found that there were only 70 trials in just under 9,000 patients. 17% of the studies had been published more than once, and the number of patients had been inflated by 28%. It was impossible to tell this from the published studies. Four pairs of identical trials were published by completely different authors without any common authorship. And this is what that achieved. This shows the real effect here. I mean, for those of you who aren't familiar with this kind of plot, all I need to tell you is it shows that a number needed to treat of 10. You need to treat 10 people to benefit one patient in the time span of the treatment. And this shows that the confidence around that is really quite broad, so it's not a very confident result. But by doing all this duplicating and slicing up and publishing in lots of different places, and they get this much prettier result of a number needed to treat of about 5 and a much more confident, narrow confidence interval. This just it shows you the ability to manipulate the evidence. And again, in case people feel that's old, because that dates back to 1997. Here's a study published only 2 years ago in the New England Journal of Medicine. And what these authors did was they looked at FDA evaluations of 12 antidepressants. And they found 74 studies. 74 studies. So each of these represents a study. And they found that whether and how the studies were published was associated with the study outcome. So you can see that those that were positive, they're not published are in dark. Those that were positive, only one of all these positive studies remained unpublished. Whereas of all those that were negative, the majority of them are unpublished. The published literature gave the impression that 94% of the trials were positive. So this is this nice little, very, very pleasing result for the drugs. But in fact, the true result was 51% are positive. And the overall boosting of the effect size for these drugs was 32%. Now, we've recently become aware of the amount of unpublished data on really quite an important drug that's just hit our society in rather a major way. And no doubt some of you went out and got some, or your employers bought some, or you were determined not to buy some. But the evidence around Tamiflu, it turns out, is really not in the public's hands. What this investigation discovered was that important claims about the effectiveness of Tamiflu on reducing complications of seasonal flu were what led governments to stockpile the drug. But in fact, when the Cochrane Collaboration tried to verify those claims, they found that 8 out of 10 of the relevant studies in over 3,000 patients had not been published. And these dated back to the end of the 90s and the early 2000s. They asked the drug company Roche for the data, but Roche declined to share it until the BMJ and Channel 4 got involved. And then they said they would share it, but they still have not done so to the extent that we feel is necessary. In the ongoing investigation, the Cochrane Collaboration team have found there are many more unpublished studies. And we've also found that one of the two published studies was almost certainly ghostwritten and contains all the evidence contained lots of inconsistencies. So we're really left with a very confused picture about whether this drug actually works. And I think we're left with a legitimate scientific concern that data used to support important public health policy decisions are held only by a commercial company and have not been subject to independent external scrutiny. Now, the question is, does this matter? Well, this is my version of a triangle that many people who work in evidence-based medicine will be all too familiar with. And at the top of the triangle is action. So what we need to do as clinicians, the actual treatment we need to give. And at the bottom of the triangle is the raw data on which those actions are supposed to be based. And on the way up to the peak are a number of analyses and different types of synopses and gathering together and evaluations until we can really say in clinical guidelines and other products what doctors should do, what patients should ask for. But what we now know over a period of years, this is not a sudden finding, it's a finding that is really dawning on us and almost feels like we should have done more about it before. The medical research is the bedrock of medical decision making, and we agree that we must base our decisions on evidence. We must have evidence-based guidelines. Vast sums of money have been used in creating such guidelines. But the quality of the evidence on which those guidelines are based is shot through with holes, and much of it is hidden from view. Now, just before coming to this lecture, I had an interesting conversation, as always, with Julian Sheather, who, if you don't know him, is someone I suggest you try to meet. He is an ethicist at the BMA. You might think it's surprising that he's such an interesting person. He said to me there are many threats to science. There are external threats, which he described as the superstitions. Science grew up at a time when there was a lot of superstition and religion, and really won out, you might say, because it seemed to have a better answer that appealed to the rational mind. So the threat to science from external sources, and then there are internal threats, corruption and other things. The external threats refuse to accept the scientific approach to evidence. The internal threats misuse the scientific approach to pursue money, status, and fame, bringing science and its practitioners into disrepute and risking people's lives in the process. And I thought, interestingly, he said it was especially toxic when these external and internal threats combine, as in the potential to stoke superstitious fears about a flu pandemic. Now, I'm just going to give one example of the potential to manipulate the data. I make a sort of apology that it's yet another industry example, but I don't apologise too much because of the overwhelmingly important role that the pharmaceutical industry plays in clinical medicine. It is a dominant role because of the vast sums of money it has at its disposal. So this is a... I'm taking this information from a paper we published in the BMJ, which looked at this story, which may be familiar to some of you. To those in medicine, I'm sure it will be familiar. It's the story of Vioxx, rofecoxib, which is a drug that was introduced by Merck in 1999 as an alternative to non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs for pain in osteoarthritis. Now, there were early concerns that it increased thrombus formation, but Merck officials persuaded the academic authors to soften their interpretation. And we know these things because, as a result of the huge lawsuits that went on in the States 5 or so years ago, the whole of the story has become public knowledge. Vioxx, Merck put the drug up for an application for licensing in 1998, but the studies used were not designed to pick up cardiovascular risk. There were 9 intervention studies, small, short treatment periods, enrolled patients at low risk of cardiovascular disease, and there were no standard procedures for collecting cardiovascular outcomes. And then they ran the Vigor study, starting in 1999. It was intended to show that Vioxx had fewer gastrointestinal side effects than naproxen for treating rheumatoid arthritis. Now, this would have been an enormously important thing to find out. The number of people who suffer from rheumatoid arthritis unable to take non-steroidal drugs because of the gastrointestinal side effects. So large amounts of money and huge benefit to patients if this proved to be true. But again, in this study, there were no standard operating procedures for collecting information on cardiovascular risk, and there was no cardiologist on the safety monitoring board. Now, this is the lovely result that they were able to show. And what it shows is that the cumulative incidence of gastrointestinal side effects, as indicated here, over this 12-month follow-up, was much higher in naproxen, the old drug, than in rofecoxib, the new drug. So this is a lovely result for the industry. However, what we now know as a result of these lawsuits is this was an interim analysis. This was not a final analysis, which wasn't made clear in the report in the New England Journal. And we also know that subsequently have discovered that there were undisclosed conflicts of interest amongst the board members. The head of the Vigor board was awarded a 2-year consulting contract 2 weeks before the trial ended, and as the trial was concluding, disclosed family ownership of Merck shares worth $70,000. Now, subsequently, this study was published in JAMA in 2001, which confirms the concerns about cardiovascular risk. So here we have the annualized myocardial infarction rate, and they've looked at placebo, rofecoxib, and another drug in the same class. And again, they found that this confirms the concerns, that there is this much higher rate of myocardial infarction in the active group. And subsequently, in the New England Journal itself, in 2004, this study was published. Again, this is a cardiovascular risk thrombotic events over 3 years, and we find that versus placebo, this new wonder drug proved to be not so wonderful after all, with this much higher risk of cardiovascular events. And when this was published, Vioxx was withdrawn. Now, one of the great tragedies of this case is that Vioxx is actually a very good drug. It's a drug that many people with arthritis would be delighted to take, and many were finding it extremely good, that they had no other drug before then had been quite so effective. And had there been openness about the increased cardiovascular risk, it's quite possible that some patients would have argued that they would like to stay on the drug at their own risk. And this seems to me to be an example of an opportunity to have been a great deal more open and grown up about the way we treat information about drugs and the way we discuss these with patients. Now, just as a nasty aftertaste for Merck on this case, another little glitch for them. They published this randomized trial of the same drug against naproxen in the Annals of Internal Medicine in 2003. But in the New York Times in 2005, the lead author of that trial was quoted as saying, "Merck designed the trial, paid for the trial, ran the trial. Merck came to me after the study was completed and said, 'We want your help to work on the paper.' The initial paper was written at Merck and then sent to me for editing." Now, this is what we in the trade call fraud. Its proper name is guest and ghost authorship, and this person is a guest author. And it brings back the fact that this whole sorry saga around Vioxx is a kind of iconic story that illustrates a whole host of potential misconducts that occur throughout clinical trials and medicine. And here are some issues that it illustrates: undeclared conflict of interest, ghostwriting and guest authorship, use of key opinion leaders to persuade and on advisory panels, pressure on academics to change what they found, journals used but benefiting financially. Because what I may not have mentioned is that New England Journal sold 1 million copies of this study and made, no doubt, vast sums of money in the process. Now, it's important to say that although the Vioxx saga unfolded about 5 to 10 years ago, all of these issues are very much, I'm afraid, still present today. And just in case people thought that guest and ghost authorship was a thing of the past, this survey was presented last year, at the end of last year in 2009, at the Peer Review Congress. And what these authors did was they surveyed corresponding authors of nearly 900 articles published in high-impact factor general medical journals, and they found that 1 in 5 admitted to at least one guest author, and that was no change since 1996, and nearly 8% admitted to at least one ghost author, slightly lower than 1996. And this was almost certainly an underestimate, as this is a self-report. Now, in case anyone's confused, the ghost authors are the unnamed, usually industry-funded writers. The guest authors are the named, usually uninvolved until the very end, industry-funded key opinion leaders. Now, key opinion leaders is a very interesting topic and one that creates a lot of emotion. This puppet is still up in my office, the one that appeared on the cover, and our commercial team really hate it when they come in and see it hanging there. But I see it as a very important conscience, and I like to see how people respond to him. He's not a very nice-looking chap, but we found him on a website from Hungary, and he seemed to illustrate this constraints that people who take up industry funding find themselves in. Ray Moynihan, one of our regular contributors to the BMJ, wrote an article in BMJ in 2008 which looked at how key opinion leaders are made. And he quoted from an article in the Pharmaceutical Marketing magazine in 2008, which quotes to saying, drug company marketing staff are urged to work routinely with key opinion leaders and try to make them into product champions. Marketing staff should find doctors who will endorse their products, who may be further down the influence ladder, and then help raise their profile and so develop them into opinion leaders. The first steps in recruiting and developing a set of opinion leaders are to evaluate their views and influence their potential, build relationships with them, and then provide the doctors with appropriate communication platforms so they can communicate on your behalf with other doctors and the wider public. Drug companies are then encouraged to evaluate the performance of their key opinion leaders continuously to avoid wasting money on the wrong person. Some firms offer web-based software to keep track of opinion leaders and show their return on investment. One firm offering such software called KOL specializes in managing opinion leaders for drug companies. Its website states that although these thought leaders in the profession may not write many prescriptions, they can influence thousands of prescribers and hence prescriptions through their research, lectures, publications, and their participation in advisory boards, committees, editorial boards, professional societies, and guideline consensus document development. And we know this is what happens. So there are a couple of studies that have really, I think, very elegantly shown that indeed opinion leaders writing in medical journals, not research, publishing research, but writing opinion articles, letters, editorials, are extremely successful in pushing the funder's point of view. So in 1998, Stelfox et al. In the New England Journal found that authors were more likely to be supportive of calcium channel blockers if they had a financial relationship with the manufacturer of the drug. 96% of supportive authors had financial relations with manufacturers, compared with 60% who were neutral and 37% who were critical. Again, that relates back to 1998, but just this year in the BMJ we published an article by Wang et al. Which looked at the latest, most controversial drug in medicine, which is rosiglitazone, a drug for treatment of type 2 diabetes. Again, a drug with an enormous potential market. I mean, this is not only in the developing world, but in the developed world, but in the developing world. And the big question about rosiglitazone is whether it increases the risk of heart attack. So it is a drug that's supposed to help diabetics, but does it actually also increase their risk of heart attack? And what Wang et al. Found was those who took favourable view were more likely to have links with manufacturers of anti-hyperglycemic agents, that's the class as a whole, and of this drug in particular. And the significant association persisted across a range of different methods of analysis. So we know this happens, we know it's effective, and we know why the drug industry puts so much effort into making it work. The other issue that many of these cases bring up is the role of the regulator. Now, there are two major regulators in my world. One is the FDA in America, and the other is the European Medicines Agency. The general view is that the FDA is the better outfit. It certainly has the better website. But I think they both have their problems. And one of the problems is that they are largely, and in the case of the EMA, entirely industry-funded. So their ability to be independent of industry is very uncertain. They also, certainly the EMA, is very secret. It's very hard to find out what goes on at the EMA. And they don't declare any conflicts of interest, so you don't know who's on their management committee. They have a guidance that says they will do that, but they don't actually do it. Another sort of more troubling and more complex issue is that when a safety issue emerges around a drug, the people who had initially approved the drug for licensing are the very same people who look at the safety concern and decide whether or not to keep it on the market. And it's only just occurred to me, this internal conflict of interest, that people who've invested a lot of time and energy to say this drug is safe and we're going to make it licensed are then asked to review their own decision. And it's hardly surprising that drugs tend to stay on the market despite quite serious safety concerns. And rosiglitazone is one of those drugs that is still on the market in the UK, still being prescribed to patients despite very serious safety concerns and despite the fact there is a perfectly or much safer alternative drug. Now, I mentioned the flu pandemic, and we've just published in the BMJ a piece of investigative journalism, I mentioned that earlier, which we did in conjunction with the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, which is a not-for-profit organisation. And what we were looking at was concerns about the lack of transparency at WHO and its failure to disclose links with vaccine and antiviral drug manufacturers in the build-up to the pandemic. It turns out that key guidance was authored by paid opinion leaders, and that WHO had a secret emergency committee of 16 members to advise the Director General, and that emergency committee made some very, very key decisions. They were about setting pre-arranged contracts that would be triggered when a pandemic was announced. They were about changing the definition of pandemic from one that included severity as part of its definition to one that was only about geographic spread. So it could be a very mild condition but cover the whole world, and that becomes a pandemic. Whereas prior to this change of definition, the definition included many, many millions of people will die. And the reason for that change in definition has never been properly explained, to my satisfaction at least. They also advised the Director General of WHO when to announce the pandemic, and then they were part of the guidance encouraging governments to stockpile antiviral drugs. Now, we know that billions of dollars of private profit have been made and huge public cost has been expended. We know three members of this 16-member committee. We've dug around and found out who they are, and one of those we know to be a paid industry consultant who's taken part in marketing activities. His photograph appears in Roche and vaccine marketing material. We also know that several key bits of guidance were authored by people who have major links with industry. Now, people have argued that it's okay that these people might take part in the decision-making, but I think certainly the people who I respect and people who have contributed to the debate say, well, perhaps they need to be consulted, but they should not take part in the decision-making. And what we feel has happened as a result of this is WHO has lost a great deal of credibility. And at its worst, this could be a major public health scam. Now, the debate about conflict of interest is always enhanced by people who say, you've gone far too far. You've gone way off the scale. And Tom Stossel is someone who says that very eloquently. And we had a debate in the BMJ about whether the hunt for conflicts of interest has gone too far, and Tom was very happy to provide the yes to this argument. And he takes the view that most, this is a quote, most people realise that asceticism and utopian zeal for behavioural perfection produce nothing, and that risk-taking entrepreneurs, motivated in part by profit, advance medicine. They do not want pious bureaucrats regulating their rewards or telling them with whom they can associate. Well, they may not want it, but medicine may need it. On the no side, we had Kirby Lee arguing that far from having gone too far, we have not gone far enough. And in response to Tom Stossel's argument that he makes in the piece that people need to consult experts, and is it their fault if all the experts are funded by industry? The response to that is to say that key opinion leaders don't arise by accident. As Tom Jefferson of the Cochrane Collaboration, who has done a lot of the work on the pandemic flu vaccine, said, key opinion leaders don't spring up like daisies. They're nurtured carefully over years, and those that don't deliver are dropped. Industry and public sector are forced to use the same pool of expertise in some fields where involvement with industry is extensive, leaving no independent people of stature. And I would add, we need to move away from a culture where our best brains are conflicted in this way. Now, to Tom Stossel's dismay, attitudes on conflict of interest are hardening, and they're hardening in two respects. One is about disclosure, that disclosure is so far inadequate, not sufficiently comprehensive. And the second is that disclosure in itself may no longer be considered to be enough. So one of the activities that's led to a real awareness raising in the States has been this rather clever farm-free scorecard, which has been developed by the American Medical Students Association. So these are medical students in America who've really decided that they've had enough, and they want to know how well medical schools do in terms of whether they have a conflict of interest policy, and if they do, what it covers. And they now publish this every year. And this has been this began back in 2007, and it's been really quite a force for people beginning to see that they've got to raise their game. As has this man, Senator Grassley. Now, this is a little extract from one of the terrifying letters he has been sending out to institutions around America, including this is a copy of the one that went to the American Medical Association, asking for all their industry relationships and in great detail he needs to have. Now, people have questioned the motivation that Senator Grassley has. Obviously, a big vote winner to do this, and he's discovered that it does make him very visible in the media. But it's certainly having an impact, and it was initially born of shock on his part, so he says, of the extent of funding for patient groups in America and their influence on national advisory panels. Now, following on from Senator Grassley's activity, which has revealed vast amounts of public or private corruption, individuals in high office earning millions and millions of dollars undeclared, many of whom have subsequently been sacked or disgraced, but some of whom have been promoted into other office. Following on from Senator Grassley's activity, there have been now strong guidelines from various associations, including the Institute of Medicine, as setting new standards for conflict of interest declaration. The Medical Specialty Society Code is particularly interesting. It emphasises the need for independence of medical societies from commercial influence, and very clearly emphasises the need for not only actual but perceived independence. It looks for the benefits of patients and members. It's nice to see the word patients mentioned in medical societies. It doesn't always happen. It asks for a separation of decisions on fundraising and programme management, so that if a society is trying to raise funds, that's perfectly legitimate from the pharmaceutical industry, this code says. But that should be independent of those people who are planning the programme and deciding what types of diseases or types of activities the society should cover. It says that marketing at meetings, it talks about the exhibiting stand. The exhibit stand should no longer be in the obligate pathway of clinicians who are walking to their lectures. And it also wants the marketing areas to be very clearly signposted, so people know that they're walking away from a place of science, you might say, into a place of marketing. A thing that interested me about the guidance was that it says that societies will require that the majority of panel members are free of conflict of interest to the subject of the guideline. This is guideline panels. And it seemed to me that that was rather weak, that the majority of panel members should be free of conflicts of interest. But it rather speaks to the fact that finding experts who are not conflicted is increasingly hard. I said that the other area of hardening of attitude is around what to do with the information. Is disclosure enough? It has been generally thought that disclosure was enough if you just make a caveat emptor statement. I have received the following. I am in regular receipt of the following amounts. I'm a major advisor to this company. And then leave the reader or the listener to make their own judgment. But there are two other options. One is that disclosure needs to be followed by a judgment. Is this amount of conflict too great? And the other is that that disclosure should result in a bar to taking part in membership of a panel or authoring an editorial or involvement in a piece of research. And the Institute of Medicine in America has taken really that view. They've taken a much, much more stringent view, published last year. And they've said that not only should medical institutions establish conflict of interest policies and have committees to evaluate these and standardise content and format, they've called upon the US Congress to legislate, which is now happening, the Sunshine Act, which is going to require employers and companies to create databases of conflict of interest. But they've also said this. They've said that researchers should not conduct research if they have a financial interest in the outcome. Now, that seems to me to be a very, very wide-reaching statement and one that I entirely applaud, but it certainly is not the case at the moment. The specific example they give is that if they hold a patent on an intervention being tested in a clinical trial. Now, that seems to me to apply to the entire pharmaceutical industry. So the question is, should we go down the same route in this country? Should UK follow the American lead? Well, someone I found very interesting to listen to and to read his work is this man, Giovanni Fava, who's a professor of psychiatry in Italy. And he's fascinating about the difference between puritanical America and Berlusconi's Italy. And his concern, on one hand, is that what's happening in America is sort of what Tom Stossel is warning us about, that actually the backlash against conflict of interest and the lack of a real inner change in the way things are done is actually leading potentially to a worse situation. And he says that in Italy, what happened with Berlusconi was that there was this big anti-corruption move in Italy, and all these incredibly competent prosecutors grew up and became very, very able and confident in prosecuting corruption. And what Berlusconi has managed to do is he's managed to bring those able prosecutors into his camp. And nobody can now get past Berlusconi. So that the whole attitude in Italy has become very warped as a result of that overkill, as he would say, on the anti-corruption side of things. He says that in America, the big loss has been a huge loss of credibility. The pharmaceutical industry feels it. What's interesting is that the medical profession doesn't yet feel it, but he says that in some areas of medicine in America, it's the end. He says child psychiatry is over in America because of all of these scandals. And he says, as I've said, that nothing really has changed, that you can change the way the marketing stands at meetings may be displayed, but not if the underlying mission of the medical society remains the same. The journals are publishing the same things. We need an internal change, he says, a proper debate and intellectual independence. That's the thing he talks about a lot, intellectual independence. And so one of his recipes, if you like, one of his strategies, is that rather than rewarding those with conflicts, we need to find to reward those without. So he thinks we should develop lines of support for independent researchers, priority for public funding for research, priority for editorships and memberships of guideline panels. He wants us, through this positive action, to build a new breed of independent expert across the whole of medicine. Now, I can't talk about the problems of science without talking a bit about journals, because they, sure enough, have their conflicts too. This is an entirely data-free slide. This is just really to try to illustrate the different sources of revenue that journals enjoy. So you'll see from my profile of the BMJ that most of our revenue comes from advertising. That's classified, that's jobs advertising and drug advertising. We also receive some money from subscriptions, and we also receive money from reprint sales, but not a lot, because we don't publish many drug trials. I'm imagining the New England Journal and other journals of that sort are rather almost the reverse to that, with certainly a good chunk of reprint sales as part of their picture. Now, editorial freedom has been described as the freedom to print those of the proprietor's prejudices that don't upset the advertisers. And it's certainly true that when the BMJ publishes something critical of the pharmaceutical industry, which we do, that advertising revenue is withdrawn. And in my 5 years as editor, I've had two episodes where I've been made aware of quite substantial losses of advertising revenue as a result of things we've published. And the Annals of Internal Medicine back in the late 80s sacked their co-editors, Bob and Suzanne Fletcher, because they published an article about the poor evidence base, that the way in which advertising in journals manipulated the evidence base. And as a result of that, one of their major advertisers withdrew a large sum of money and the journal sacked their authors, their editors. Now, you could say it's hard enough for big journals like us, but how much harder for the millions of small journals completely reliant on advertising revenue or on reprint revenue? How much harder for them to speak out when they see problems arising? So peer review has many problems, and here are just a few of them. All of these have been shown to be the case, and I think really one of the premises of what I'm trying to say is that the traditional systems of peer review and quality control are unequal to the task. They're predicated on the idea that we are all committed and all abide by the Mertonian norms of disinterestedness and organised scepticism. And it's clear that we are not all committed to those. Medicine and healthcare are a business. It's not just about industry, although, as I've said, it's a major part of the problem. It's also about fee-for-service in medicine, private clinics, self-referral from one public clinic into your own private clinic. There's a lot of evidence about that. It's also very clear that medical journals are businesses too. Now, we are moving towards greater transparency in the literature. We have trial registration, we have publication of protocols, we have data sharing, we're beginning to mandate data availability. We have unlimited space online, which is a great bonus in terms of making sure that a whole study is published in one place. We have now a uniform conflict of interest form across journals. We have open access growing across the literature, which is a huge asset, although many people think of it as a great threat. We have open peer review, and increasingly we're doing this thing of publishing the history of the paper once it's been published so that you can see what happened to it before it was published. And we have article-level metrics, which are intending to replace what many of you will know is the invidious impact factor, which is another source of loss of independence in journals. But will any of this really help? Do we need instead to look to a more radical future of transparency and independence? And this is my recipe for change. Bizarre or extreme though it may sound, we should stop pharmaceutical companies directly evaluating their own products. In a debate I took part in Oxford, one of the people from the floor said, even the most ardent Manchester United supporter would not expect Alex Ferguson to referee the match. Now, people would say, well, how will research be done? How will industry trial, how will drugs be evaluated? Well, there is a system already in Italy. Silvio Berlusconi, another great hero, says he managed to get this law passed while the rest of the Italians were on holiday. What it constitutes is that 5% of marketing budgets for industry, for the pharmaceutical industry, 5% of their marketing budget goes into a central pot, and that central pot funds independent research, the sorts of research that the pharmaceutical industry will not do. So a model exists, and it's not inconceivable that we could do this. That is what that relates to. The other idea has come up out of this discussion around the WHO pandemic. Where are we supposed to go for expert advice if all of the experts are industry funded? Well, someone suggested a central industry funding, a pot of money that could be used for independent advice. The advisors need paying. I mean, nobody wants to give their advice for free, but they need to be independent of any one drug company. And I think it's important to say that actually the industry may benefit, because one of the other Berlusconi anecdotes is that he has this vast kind of cabal of advisors and consultants who he pays, who therefore never say no to him. He's you know, why would they say no? They lose their job if they say no. So what industry has at its worst is a cabal of people who won't tell them what they need to hear. And it's possible that independent advice would serve the pharmaceutical industry far better than the paid advice that they are currently receiving. Publication of entire data sets. Well, the Tamiflu saga illustrates the need for this. We could, I think, be moving towards a thing called radical transparency. I looked it up on Wikipedia. where not only the ordinary information of interest to the community is made freely available, but all, or nearly all, of the meta levels of organising and decision-making are also published. And there are some parts of the scientific community where this happens anyway, but in medicine we seem to be some way from that. And my final thing is a return to investigative journalism, and this is something the BMJ is committed to, which I'm delighted about. So why do we need investigative journalism? Well, news, it has been said, is what someone somewhere wants to suppress. All else is advertising. Hugh Clegg, another great editor of the BMJ, and one who really affirmed the BMJ's independence. He was a very brave, outspoken editor, and there was an attempt by the BMA to make sure that all that he wrote got checked before it was published, which managed to get pushed out aside. But he was very, very strong on independence. And I get periodical reminders from BMJ readers that editorial independence is a privilege not to be exploited. But what I like about Hugh Clegg and others admire him for is this statement: a subject that needs reform should be kept before the public until it demands reform. Richard Smith, my predecessor, wrote a rather nice piece on why muckraking is an honourable tradition. And he refers back to the 19th century asking why this isn't happening in medicine anymore. Why is there no medical private eye? And he talks about the fact that proper investigative journalism is expensive, gossip is cheaper but less useful. There are restrictive libel laws, which Sense About Science has done a great deal to tackle. It doesn't fit with the medical culture. Humour is hard to write. And there's no business model and no entrepreneur. Well, as I say, the BMJ is now looking to do investigative journalism. And the pandemic flu is one example, and we've also done some work on whistleblowing. So what is the public to make of all this, and what must our medical institutions, legislators and civil society do? Well, beginning with civil society, it's important that we raise awareness. We need to establish systems to make disclosure the norm. And we need then, if we follow Giovanni Fava's idea, rather than imposing something, we need then to have a grown-up debate on what to do with that information. The legislators, well, I think we know now from the American situation that you can't rely on individuals to declare their own conflict of interest. So I think we would agree that putting the onus on employers and companies to declare all payments is a very good solution, because you can then cross-check and there's a verification. We need to reform the regulators to make them more independent of the industry that they're supposed to regulate. And I think we need to establish a central pool of pharmaceutical funds for independent trials and independent advice. The institutions. Well, a code of best conduct, a practice for clinicians, is about to be developed in collaboration with the Department of Health, the BMJ, and hospital trusts. We asked the trusts whether they had conflict of interest policies. They tend to go for the senior management, and even that's not complete. They have very little for the clinicians themselves. The Royal Colleges, we feel their role should be to raise awareness among members and set up advisory groups on conflict of interest, but probably not to mandate it for their members. Better leaving that to the employers. And the GMC could make this a doctor's duty. They could beef up good medical practice and make it a duty to declare your conflicts. As for the public, well, the failure of the system to achieve organised scepticism means that, for the moment at least, they must question everything. And this is not to make people cynical, but I think to be appropriately sceptical. They have to ask additional questions. Not only has it been peer-reviewed, but also how independent is it? Who paid for it? What biases might there be? What conflicts of interest have been declared? Are there likely to be others? Have people had full access to the data? I think we all need to seek opportunities for open discussion about conflict of interest. We need to strive to be independent ourselves and find ways to reward it in others. Independent is not a privilege, it's a duty. Thank you.
Right, we have a short time for questions, and I'm sure that many of the things that Fiona's raised are fairly controversial, certainly things that people would want to question and explore a bit further. So I do hope that some of you have some questions. Yeah. Sorry, I'm not. Could you say who you are? I'm at risk of offending people if I start saying when I know I recognise you, and then I'm going to forget somebody's name. So, if you could actually just introduce who you are, that'd be great. Thanks.
My name is Caroline Richmond, and I'm the founder of a group called Healthwatch. I enjoyed your talk, especially the bit about Hugh Clegg, and I wonder, his grandson Nick Clegg is in a very good position. Does he know what a good chap his grandfather is?
He does know. He does know. And at a Centre about Science lecture, or he was giving a lecture at the Royal Society, he referred to his grandfather and the links with the BMJ. So we would like to invite him round for dinner at some stage, but he's a bit busy at the moment.
So. Okay, yeah.
John Martin from University College London and Yale. Conflict of interest, I founded a public biotechnology company. I think much of what you say is inherent in capitalism. And you could have said the same about BP and data as you are saying about drug industry. But I do think you really addressed the cause in our universities of this attitude towards data and towards education. And I think as a professor of cardiology, we are driven to produce small science by the way we're funded. Uncreative science, and we've entered a filial relationship with industry. Mm. So I think we didn't address the cause, and I think the cause is within the nature of university funding and the way we are rewarded as professors to get promotion and more cash into our personal bank account by publishing certain sorts of papers. Mm.
Now, I think that's a very good point. I mean, I suppose I would argue that that doesn't mean that those links shouldn't be declared. I think at the very first level we are failing. In the UK, I think there's still a sense of denial about this. And I think in America, where they are ahead is that they are forcing the issue of declaration. So I'd absolutely agree. I think you're quite right that problems with funding are an issue. But it still means we can be transparent.
Okay, what I'm going to do, I can see a lot of hands going up now. If you don't mind, Fiona, I'm going to take a few questions and then give you a bit of time to draw breath. So the woman there who's in front of Simon Wesley, who obviously doesn't know that she's in front of Simon Wesley, so if you would just... Okay, and then actually just going straight back, I'll take you and then behind that, yeah. Okay.
Hi, I'm Tessa Kendall from the National Secular Society. I was just wondering if you might have any ideas for how we equip and encourage the public to be more questioning, because it's not just a question of saying they should be, it's a lot of them aren't equipped to be, and how can we engage with that?
Yeah. Okay. And then, yeah.
Simon Wesley from King, the person behind Tessa.
Yeah, I wasn't sure, genuinely not sure. If you were actually being tongue-in-cheek about Silvio Berlusconi, or you really were putting him forward as an example of probity, I was genuinely baffled from the way you were talking as to which view you had.
I meant Garattini. Did I say Silvio Berlusconi?
You said Berlusconi quite a lot, actually. There is...
I'm so sorry.
It's no, kind of a fundamental difference between the two.
Sorry. No, I mean, I'm actually unable to go to Italy at the moment because my husband won't go. I mean, we couldn't go to America for 8 years. Now we can't go to Italy.
So scratch Berlusconi from the argument.
I'm
it was
so sorry.
Very confusing.
Forgive me, I'll have to rewind.
Okay.
Silvio Garattini, and I've got a photograph of him, but I didn't manage
to... Well, I'm sure he'll be suing you very shortly.
Yeah, thank you.
But anyway, I was worried. You made a point about absolute conflicts of interest, where there's a conflict that should be declared. But you also said that was just the same as perceived conflict of interest, and that's always rather worrying, because perception is very much in the eye of beholder. I could be a paranoid, psychotic, borderline personality disorder person.
Say that too often,
that's very fine, I do. But I could see, you know, that you have a conflict of interest, which is completely in my imagination, but it is a perception. And therefore, according to you, that would be sufficient. You don't take any account of any actual evidence for conflict. Merely that I think that you're biased is sufficient. Is that what you mean?
Well, when I said that, I was quoting from the Medical Society's new guidance, where they say they say that society should strive to be independent and should I mean, I can't remember, the actual and perceived independence is a phrase they use. Now, I think you're right to call on it, because it is a phrase that suggests a certain amount of sort of cynicism if you're going to try and just go for the perceived and not bother with the actual. And certainly that's not what I'm arguing. But I do know, for the BMJ point of view, that we have a number of conflicts of interest that we manage as best we can around advertising and reprint revenue, and we work very hard to make sure there is actual independence. But we also work hard to make sure that the world out there knows that, because that means they can be more confident in what we're publishing. So the advertising, we have a Chinese wall. We don't. Our advertisers don't know what's going in the journal. We don't know what. So I mean, you could say that's actual, but in terms of making people aware of it, it's also to do with the perception. But
okay, can I take a couple more? I'm sure there will be more questions on that point actually. But can I take a couple more points? Just raise your hand if you were indicating at the back there. Yeah, there, and then here. Yeah, thank you.
I'm Rob Lyons from the web site Spiked. I mean, I agree completely with your general thrust that people should declare their interests. I do think it's a serious problem from the point of view of a layperson, the idea that drugs aren't somehow independently tested, we just gather together, you know, whatever research papers are out there, it seems, you know, remarkable, I'm sure. But we also need to, it's not just a company thing, it's not just a corporate thing, that actually, people who just have a bee in their bonnet about things, or enough to be part of a campaigning group, for example, might be just as biased and produce just as bad science as somebody who's being paid to say a certain thing or is being backed financially. So we do need to be careful about all these things, and we do need to sort of take account of all of these declared interests, not just the financial ones. Because at the end of the day, what we're really saying is it any good? And I don't think that looking for the financial connections is a kind of a way of getting around the problem of asking that question, is it any good? So, for example, the WHO might be riddled with all sorts of dodgy connections, but actually wouldn't have taken anybody very long last year to realise that Margaret Chan was talking rubbish about swine flu, and that actually the WHO's response was completely overblown. And so, for the better or the worse, we just need to be, as you say, appropriately sceptical at every level, and also ask, is this science any good?
Okay, that's very useful, actually. Relates also to the public question. I'll just take one more point, maybe come back on that.
I just wonder if we're being a little bit precious about all this. Aeroplanes are designed, tested, and sold entirely by the manufacturers. They don't create a few complications in one or two patients. A dodgy aeroplane will kill 200 people stone dead instantly. But nobody ever talks about conflict of interest in the testing of aeroplanes.
Well, they probably do. Do you want me to answer on this?
Yeah.
Just on that last one, I mean, the slightly facetious comment, but there was a view as to why doctors killed more patients than airline pilots. And it was to do with a number of things like checklists and duplicate procedures and stuff, but also because if doctors knew they would die with their patients, they'd take a great deal more care. but I think the other thing is that I'm not an ethicist, so I may not be able to make much sense of this, but there is an argument that if you're looking at in terms of the public good, that healthcare is in a slightly unusual frame. That one's talking about a slightly different ethical code around values of healthcare. But I mean, we could argue that one. I may not make much sense of it. In terms of public engagement, I think that we have to do a better job of demystifying some of these issues. I think that there is a tendency to believe that this is sort of out there and not for their discussion. And I think we can do a great deal more to explain, as I think Sense About Science is working on, the basic mechanics of scientific approach to evaluating treatments. And I think that we can do a great deal more to just articulate what types of conflict of interest and what types of influences may be at play. So I think it is a long, slow process of education. And then, of course, the more that we push the transparency, the more that we make the data available, the more that we explain the deeply shocking fact that most drugs currently on the market have not been independently evaluated. I mean, I find it shocking, and I think it's really extraordinary. Most of the data underlying the treatments we routinely prescribe and take are in the hands of the commercial sector and not transparently available. So I think we should make that clear to people, and I think they should be shocked too. You asked about non-financial conflicts of interest. I think that's absolutely crucial as well. It's rather more tricky. There's something slightly simpler about dollar amounts, but I agree there's a slightly spurious simplicity about that, and we mustn't forget that the non-financial conflicts of interest, which can be very powerful.
Okay, let's take a few more questions. I'm aware there's quite a number of people on this section here, so should we just take yes, chat there, and followed by the guy two rows in front of him, come across here, yeah.
Thank you. George Freeman, now a Member of Parliament, but for 15 years before I've been working in commercialisation of early stage science. There were two quick comments. The first was, I really enjoyed the lecture, and I thought it was fascinating and some really interesting observations about how we could improve the system. A slight worry at what appeared to be the underlying thesis that if you have any commercial interest in science, then you are in some way illegitimate. You can't be relied upon to be objective. And I just worry, I mean, there's clearly some abuse going on, but I just worry that that idea might make it impossible for really great scientists who want to see their science commercialised to be involved. The second comment was that I think the most interesting thing you said in the middle of the lecture was that so many of these drugs, in fact, the real disaster is that they would be very, very successful drugs for sort of 80, 90% of the population. And I can't help thinking that the really big answer is to try and open up the regulatory framework, be more mature about recognising the more we know about humans and medicine, the more we're going to realise that no drug is a blockbuster, and encouraging the pharmaceutical industry to stop trying to prove that it is a perfect blockbuster and create a more mature regulatory regime.
Thank you. And then...
Hi. David Alan Green. I write the Jack of Kent blog. Declaration of interest. I'm a lawyer, so presumably I shouldn't be writing about libel reform. And if I do, nobody should put any rate on what I write. You mentioned libel a couple of times. Simon Singh's victory before the Court of Appeal gave a certain indication that for certain types of writing, the law will treat it as fair comment or honest opinion, and thus make it easier for scientists and science writers to defend. Do you think the Court of Appeal decision in the Simon Singh case has had that effect? Has it effectively taken libel out of science? Or, from your point of view, is there still libel chill?
I just tell you, Fiona, there is a right answer and a wrong answer to that, as far as sense
about
science
is concerned. I'm trying to give my independent thinking.
Can I just take Evan Harris there as well?
Yes. Evan Harris, I used to be a member of the Science and Technology Select Committee. Now, I tend to agree with Fiona in what she says, not just because she occasionally, or her BMJ occasionally pays me to write for it, but I ought to make that clear. But one of the questions is, firstly, the Select Committee in its last report, I think, argued, and this is something for policymakers now, that the public sector, what's left of it after tomorrow, should mandate both open access publishing and the placing of all the data that's required that you described, given that most institutions can now do this through the internet. And I'd be interested to know what prospects you thought there were of that recommendation, or a beefed up version of it which related to climate change data at the CRU being implemented. And the second point is that everything you said about conflict of interest, of course, applies in public policy to NGOs who seem to get away with it. The Food Standards Agency had a committee where someone was paid full-time by an NGO to promote their aims, which include attacking industry, and she was able to resign from a committee, attacking the committee for asking industry for its views, and didn't get a negative press, even though there was an essentially undeclared conflict of interest, or at least a conflict of interest, which forces her in that case, I think it was Gene Watch, wasn't it, if she was doing her job properly, to have a go in the press every now and again at regulators and industry. So there is an imbalance, and I think NGOs, good or bad, are getting away with it.
Mm. That's a very good point. Yeah, do you want me to take those? If I take them in reverse order, I mean, on the open access publishing and the availability of data, all I can say is I very much hope that does come about. It seems to me that I don't see what the alternative is. Peer review, good though it can be, and you know, at its best, is just not up to the job of making safe the decision-making around evaluation of treatments. And I think that the only way is to make those data available so that people who are really interested and have the skills can go in and look at them. And there is an increasingly sophisticated debate about how that can happen. There's obviously lots of technology and there's lots of sort of policy issues. But I think there's no kind of ethical or rational reason why we shouldn't do it. And I think we should fight to make that happen. The NGO thing, I think you're absolutely right. And I mean, the same would true in government. We shouldn't say that government-funded research is in any way less open to biases than industry-funded research. Of course it is. It's just that the scale of it is so much less. I think that they're so much smaller. The libel chill, I think just to say Simon Singh's victory was a huge victory on the back of a great tragedy, personal tragedy for him, in terms of the impact it's had on his life. So I think we should really congratulate Sense About Science on that. Speaking for my own work, it hasn't changed very much as yet. We still send everything to lawyers. We still have to take stuff off our website. We still have to negotiate on wording. We are constrained by the libel laws at the moment still. And I hope that passes soon. And you mentioned about the problem of saying that commercial interests meant you couldn't evaluate drugs. So I've forgotten where you are. Hi. My sense is that we have to make a distinction here between developing new drugs and evaluating them. It seems to me perfectly, absolutely fine that entrepreneurs can develop drugs and biotech companies and even the big drug companies sometimes, although less and less. But when it comes to evaluating those drugs, that seems to me to not have the commercial sensitivity that the drug industry would like to apply to it. They're saying, we can't let people know this because it's commercially sensitive, but they're selling the drug and they're making it available and they're benefiting from that. And that seems to me to be entirely... I just don't understand the justification behind that. Sorry, you mentioned about mature contracts. I absolutely agree. There's an idea maybe we should have a new contract with the public, that the drug industry should say, no drug is entirely safe. If you're going to take our drug, there's a chance you're going to drop down dead. 1 in 100 of you is going to drop down dead. You can't sue us for that. That's just the basic stats of this drug. And I think we need to have a much more mature understanding of the risks of healthcare. It's not risk-free, and to pretend it is very damaging to everyone involved.
Okay, I've got, I think, time just to take a couple of very quick comments. I'm conscious of having neglected this side of the room. So, in fact, shall we just take 1, 2, 3 there, like that? Really briefly, if you can.
John Oversby, University of Reading, but that doesn't really mean much in the context of my comment. In 30 hours' time, I'm going to have my medication for diabetes reviewed by my doctor. You talked about education. I try my best, but I'm not quite sure which of it I can trust, and I'm fairly well... known for being interested in science, Sense About Science, and all the rest of it. But the danger is just saying we can educate people clearly isn't enough. I can read the labels. I can read the labels, but who's it produced by? So my question is it really good enough just to say we can educate people to do better when it really isn't good enough for us to do that? It's not very helpful, is it?
Okay, can we just go forward to... There was another question, another point here. Sorry, yeah. Actually, could you just stop off by way of Leonor Sierra, because she really will be upset with me if I don't take her. She's been indicated for ages. And then we'll come across to there, yeah.
So, Leonor Sierra from Sense About Science. By the way, I'm the one to come to about the sweepstakes rules. No, I just wanted to go back to the peer review point, because it's something that we've done a lot of work on in Sense About Science. And I think that whilst it's really important to the scientific community to scrutinize peer review and see how we can improve it, I think something we have found is that it's of immense use also to the public. And I think we cannot lose about sight of the good points of what peer review has allowed us to do, of what the system means that we can, you know, put papers out there that then other people can go on and replicate. And I think especially when talking to the public, it's really important to keep that in mind. And even if we're going to be talking about how we can improve it and make it better and what are the challenges, not lose sight of what we have gained by it.
Great, yeah, thank you. And then here, yeah.
Robin Weiss, UCL. How do you as editors resist a conflict of interest when you think you have a scoop and your inadequate peer reviewers are more sceptical? I'm thinking, for instance, of the original MMR paper in another journal, which was eventually retracted on the grounds of conflict of interest, but in fact it was just a crap paper to begin with. I mean, there's another virus too. It gets rounds now with high claims that it's linked to autism, that it's linked to CFS, etc. The positive investigators who find a positive link are getting into the real top impact journals. Those who are not finding a positive link are getting into much lower impact journals. Well, I agree with you. We shouldn't have impact factors, except for papers, not for journals. But how do you resist a scoop? Because maybe editors are at risk of becoming tabloid too.
That's a great question to finish. I suspect that we're going to have to continue it over drinks anyway. But Fiona, do you want to say a few things?
I'm just on that one. Then I mean, I think it is hard, but you know, one has to resist the scoop. If it says that science doesn't stand up, then you have to resist the scoop. I think the MMR paper was a very poor paper. And there were ethical concerns, but at its base, it was a very poor piece of science. So I think, and that the retrovirus in Science, the one that's linked to chronic fatigue syndrome, equally, I would say, a very poor paper. So I think that you just have to resist the scoop, and what else can one say? That we have to know that we're here for the public good. I mean, I say it sounds very cheesy, but we're here in the public interest, and if we forget that, then we do great damage.
Thank you. There's so much more that it's possible to do justice to in a short question session, but you're staying for a drink and everyone will have an opportunity to discuss this with us and with you afterwards. So thank you once again, Fiona.
Just a very few wind-up remarks before I invite you all to have a drink. Tracy's already mentioned the partners in this lecture, and we're very grateful to them. I won't repeat their names because they're on the programme. Want to thank Tracy herself for chairing this in the most expert and amusing fashion. And I also want to thank the people who've really been responsible for organising this lecture as much as anyone, and that's the volunteers from the Voice of Young Science and also the young trainees from the Institute of Physics and Engineering and Medicine who've helped make this a special occasion. When a new institute or organization gets started, it develops in all sorts of unexpected ways. I mean, we certainly didn't expect to have a great campaign about libel reform. But also, there's a number of unexpected, exciting developments. And I think one of the most exciting ones in the last few years in Sense About Science has been the Voice of Young Science. They really have been a tonic. They are the most effective campaigners we have against bad science in many ways. Certainly, they rouse the most enthusiasm. And what is interesting is how far in other countries their fame has spread and they really want to copy it in the United States, Portugal, Spain, Slovenia. They've asked, well, how can we organise something very similar? So I want to thank them very much for their work. And lastly, Fiona, may I add my personal thanks. We've had a series of annual lectures which I think have been excellent and stimulating, but I think in tonight's lecture was probably the most important one we've had so far. And I'll make one prediction. Tracy said that we are starting this development campaign for a five-year program and wondered whether at the end of 5 years we might perhaps have shown that we're no longer needed. Well, I'm willing to bet that in the light of what you've told us about the state of evidence-based medicine today, and despite all the reforms which you've advocated, I don't somehow think they're all going to be achieved, and I somehow think that in 5 years' time we'll still be fighting bad science everywhere. Thank you very much indeed.